Okie dokie. So we're live.
Okie dokie.
Oh, so I've got it on. I've already messed it up. I broke the cardinal rule. Okay. Anyway. Well, hello everyone. My name is Thomas.
I'm Emma.
I'm Chris.
And welcome to Paleo Party. This is a podcast where we invite a new paleo guest to hang out with us and talk nonsense about paleontology. But Paleo Party is a podcast with a difference because we live stream each episode on twitch.tv/paleoparty, so you can get involved and ask us and our guests anything you like. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome our first ever guest to Paleo Party. She's doing her PhD at the University of Uppsala in Sweden, and she is a specialist in fossil poop. It's Hannah Byrne!
Hey! Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
So we're asking all of our guests that join us to attempt to explain their research using the OpGore 5 editor, which only allows you to use the most common 1,000 words in English language to explain a complex idea. Obviously, this is a bit extreme, especially seeing as neither paleontology nor fossils are involved in these 1,000 words. But it's a rather fun exercise. You can see ours on the PaleoParty website, and we've asked Hannah if she would attempt to do one for us. So take it away, Hannah.
Okay. So unfortunately, poo was none of the top 1,000 words, which I, you know, debate. But so mine came out as, I look at old brown stuff from a long time ago. We use cool things to look inside the old brown stuff. We can tell who owns the brown stuff and who it was eating. I also look at hard body stuff from animals from a long time ago and the steps these animals made.
Okay, that's worrying true. Because I am drinking brown stuff. So I don't know if I like that one.
It's actually really straightforward. I'm really jealous of people who don't have to like explain computational stuff. Brown stuff is perfect.
I mean, I had to push synchrotron scanning into cool things. So, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So basically you said that you look at poop, and I definitely saw footsteps.
Yes.
So footsteps is in the top 1,000 words, or did you use two words?
No. The steps these animals make.
Oh, the steps these animals take. My bad. That's pretty good, in fairness. Well, how would you describe your research if you didn't have to use the 1,000 most common words?
Okay, so I look at material from East Greenland that dates back to the Devonian Carboniferous boundary, and it's a lake deposit that sits on the boundary. So essentially, my supervisors have gone over there over the course of 7 years, 7 field seasons, and collected a lot of material, I think over 1,000 specimens. So it's my delightful job to kind of interpret these fossils, and a lot of the fossils are actually fossilized poo, or known to us more so as coprolites. And the kind of traditional methods of observing coprolites have been thin sectioning and trying to then make wax models. But recently it's been discovered that synchrotron scanning is very useful to actually look inside the coprolites. And then you can reconstruct them virtually using 3D software. So that's essentially, what I've been doing. And I've also been involved in some side projects. One of them is looking at some of the early tetrapod trackways. So I've been involved in fieldwork in Valencia Island in Ireland, where we got to 3D scan. Yeah, 3D is a big... so we got the 3D scan the trackways, which is super cool. And yeah, I help out in some field work in the south of Sweden, looking at some late Triassic material and deep time tides.
Tides,
yes. That's how I got into paleontology in the first place, was through tides.
How did you get into paleontology through tides? This is kind of fascinating because I also love tides.
Oh.
And weirdly enough, I have also worked on paleo tides.
I'll just see really? Myself. Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
I was like, I don't know. So it was through my master's. And well, okay, this is a bit of a story time. Are we ready for a bit of a story time? So it all started way back in February 2016, I want to say. I think it was 16, actually. Where Professor Steve Balbus from the University of Oxford came to give a talk at Bangor. And he's head of astrophysics there. So I kind of saw his talk of kind of linking astronomy and the evolution of life. And I was like, well, this looks like it's going to be worth going to. So he essentially started describing, you know, how he has a big interest in the Earth, Sun, Moon system and, you know, how, what's so special about that and why we have life on Earth today and, you know, and observing exoplanets, you know, what kind of special criteria should there be for life on Earth? So he kind of starts off with all his kind of gravitational forcings and all these equations. And I'm sat there like, oh, geez, I'm lost. But he essentially brings it into the kind of the gravitational forcings of the moon and the sun, despite how different the mass of both these objects are, and also, objects, not a great word, but we'll go along with it. And also the different distances from the Earth, the forcing is only out by a power of 2, and this gives you modulated tides. So that's why from one high tide to the next, there's a slight difference. So we kind of thought, okay, you know, what period in the evolution of life could this be quite critical? And he looked upon the Devonian period when fish started to move on to land, and he noticed the continental configurations could be optimal for what's called tidal resonance. So essentially, like you're tuning a guitar, you know, you hit the right note. So when you get an ocean basin of a certain width, then you get larger tides. So, and the idea of tidal ranges influencing the fish tetrapod transition is kind of bounced around for a while. You have like Romer with the drying pool hypothesis, and other paleontologists have suggested similar, but they haven't looked at it from a kind of numerical point of view. They've always, you know, looked at the fossil kind of side of things. So he set about doing a numerical model, and so there's some basis for large tides. And so his next thought was like, okay, we should try and do this. A theoretical model. Then he wanted to do a numerical model. And so he was like, oh, okay, well, I'll contact the oceanographers in Oxford. They were like, oh, we don't do this kind of thing, but there's this crazy guy up in Bangor, who's my supervisor, who does things like this. So after I went to talk, I was like, I really want to do this. So yeah, that essentially went down that slippery road down to paleontology. So it was a big collaborative effort. So there was myself, my supervisor, other people from Oxford, Per Alberg was involved. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got contact with him. I went about making tidal simulations from the late Silurian into the middle Devonian, which I can happily say it's been quite the road to get it published, but it's been accepted.
Congratulations!
So yeah, people will be able to read up on that soon. So yeah, it's quite
interesting.
Oh, nice.
In awe of everybody who gets to publish their undergrad and master's thesis, mine is still going around in circles.
It's been quite the slog. I'm not gonna lie. We almost got accepted somewhere, but it very late got blocked by some people. So
I guess this is what took you to Uppsala. Just the general progression.
Well, yeah. So through doing the tide stuff, then I was trying to, like, you know, marry it in with the paleontological record. And the more I looked at it, because I'm not going to lie, I was really naive. I was kind of thinking like paleontology was just dinosaurs, which, no offense, dinosaur people, that's totally fine. Just
see Thomas my cup of tea. In the background. Yeah.
I'm just moving forward to be more comfortable. I'm definitely not, there was no preempting that.
I think it's also like a huge part of ignorance on my side. Like the more I've learned about dinosaurs, the more I have respect. I mean, I think it's, you always hear this, you know, T-Rex, and like, you know, you only hear about the big lads, but there's much more to it, you know?
The big lads. Well, talking of
I'm going to add that.
Yeah, talking of T-Rex, we've already had one comment in the chat saying that they love your shirt, Emma.
Oh, so thank you.
There's obviously some T-Rex fans in the chat already.
That's great.
We should mention, actually, we are an interactive podcast. It's our vibe. So if you have any questions for Hannah or for the rest of us, send them in to the chat here on Twitch. Or you can send them into our Twitter handle, which is @PaleoParty. And we strongly encourage them to be about absolutely anything, be that research or mundanities of life. So if you want to find out about, I don't know, Thomas's favorite DM campaigns, then go nuts.
Yeah, or Chris's mustache routines. facial hair care.
The comb that he uses.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't think anyone logging in this evening expected it to be welcome to Paleo Tidal Party. But yeah. we've had a good chat about paleotides, which are pretty amazing, like geological. It's amazing that from the rocks you can work out tides. And one thing that's very important that I think we should say at this point as well to our listeners is that tides, well, what we consider tides today, as in sort of twice a day, every day, and also twice at night, so four times, is not the same in the geological past, because the Earth and the Moon have been closer together and further apart at different periods of geological time. So months were shorter. Like in the Carboniferous, months were a lot shorter than they are today. So it is a pretty interesting and amazing research topic. But moving off on track, Hannah, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're working on at the moment and what your PhD is on?
Yeah, of course.
Poop.
Yeah.
So, basically, I want to talk about poo.
Yeah. Well, I get back to the poo stuff. So I work on a range of different coprolites. In fact, the morphotypes of coprolites we have is greater than the diversity in the body fossil record from this assemblage. So, because it's a lake, it's quite a closed system. So we only have at the moment one Actinop species, Actinopterygian.
What is an Actinopterygian?
It's a rayfin fish.
Thank you.
One Acanthodian, a spiny shark species. One Chondrichthyan, sharky boy. Am I forgetting anything? No, I think that's it. So we only have the three fish species, mainly dominated by the rayfin fish. But the morphotypes of coprolites we have, I think we have maybe six or seven. So you're kind of, it's quite interesting, but it's a bit like a detective series. That's how I like to view it, because I also really love detective series. But what's also really interesting is the fragments that we find inside some of the coprolites indicate to different species. So we have fragments belonging to probably another Actinopterygian or another rayfin fish species. And we also probably have some tetrapod elements as well. So not just the fragments in size inside, but also some of the size and the shapes of the coprolites kind of indicate that they're tetrapods. So how can we tell this? Well, back at that time, a lot of fish had spiral gut valves, and somewhere in the fish to tetrapod transition, this was lost. They're still not quite sure how high up the tree, but we do have quite a few like big decent sized. So I'm holding up what I'm trying to show, but Pear likes to say like a big sized poo that you'd find from a dog in a park, that kind of size. And they're non-spiral, so that kind of points towards that it's probably from a tetrapod, but that we're just not capturing in the body fossil record there.
So for our listeners, I should just point out that a coprolite is a term for a fossil poo.
Yes. Yeah, I did say that.
Yes.
But yes, to reiterate.
Yeah.
So in preparation for this, I decided to look up a few things about coprolites. And just that you mentioned morphotype, I think is a good time to jump in with what I got, because otherwise it doesn't tie in at all. Whenever I hear something new, I always go straight to the paleobiology database, which I work on extensively, and I always check if it's there or what else I can find from it, if it is there. And I've discovered it's quite hard to pick up coprolites in it, because I work on body fossils, so I have no idea about the other realms within the database that aren't body fossils. But I decided just to type in like coprolite, and I came up with a single like poor insect species from somewhere in Germany, and it wasn't very interesting. But I did want to know, like ichnotaxa, so like taxa from trackways where you see the footprints, they'd come with their own species names and genera that don't really equate to body fossil names. And is that the same for coprolites?
Yes.
And do you have any cool names as an extension of that question?
So I don't. And it's a bit of a deliberation, I think, between coprolite researchers. I know some really like to assign the ichnotaxa name to them, others don't. And you can understand from like a multitude of places. And I think it does, yeah, I don't know where I stand on that. I mean, I haven't assigned any yet, so. But it can sometimes, I think, maybe get a little confusing, especially when you have the body fossil record name and then the name for this ichno species of a coprolite or a trackway. But at the same time, then if you're trying to, I mean, that is one of the troubles that you have with ichno fossils, is trying to assign it to a body fossil or to a producer. You know, that you always have to take it with a pinch of salt, particularly with, you know, these big, large non-spiral coprolites that we have, because we say, oh, they're produced by tetrapods, but we don't have tetrapods in the body fossil record. So we have to be careful about, you know, saying this for definite. So, yeah.
I'm just really curious, this whole like poo morphology thing. How, yeah. Walk me through it. What lines up there? Like, curly boys, straight boys. I'm not like, I'm just one of these things where I'm like, what, how many different varieties can you have?
Okay. So for spiral coprolites, there's a little bit more structure. And I say that vaguely. But essentially you have three types of spiral coprolites. You have the two main ones are amphipolar and heteropolar. So amphipolar is described as if the posterior segment of the spiral exceeds 75% of the length of the coprolite, then it's described as amphipolar.
What?
And then heteropolar.
This is more maths than I signed up for.
Well, okay, I like the way that you were thinking about the maths, whereas my first thought of the logistics of how you squeeze that out.
I think it's to do with the different spiral guts. So sharks, I always forget this. I looked this up earlier today. Sharks have a particular one. So whatever shape, I think it's heteropolar. But I could be wrong. I think they usually produce them in that shape. But the likes of lungfish or like earlier ray fin fishes, I think, tend to be more amphipolar. And then you have this scroll coprolite, which I only came across recently. Which has only been found in a couple of late Silurian coprolites from Ireland and Scotland. And it's essentially like if you're rolling up a paper, like it's just like a scroll. So they're not sure. They think it's a detritivore that may have produced it. But yeah,
this is fascinating. Yeah. I had no idea. I think my only insight into any of this was that like paper that went crazy on like newspapers and stuff about wombats and their square poop.
Wombats have square poop. So weird. Well, I wanted to ask because you talked at the beginning of the episode about a synchrotron, and for our listeners, a synchrotron is a huge piece of equipment. It's the size of several football fields, and it's basically a particle accelerator. So it fires electrons using a special gun into a big chamber that is controlled by very, very powerful electromagnets, and it speeds up this electron to about 99.9% of the speed of light. And it the electrons fire around this ring until basically they're up to speed. And if you were to like map out the distance that these electrons travel, they would travel like around the solar system and back like several thousand times. And they're just flying around. And then what we do is we use these magnets to bend the electrons really quickly. And that creates a special type of light, which emits some of the most powerful X-rays on the planet. So it's really good for looking inside fossils without destroying them. So I wanted to know, you talked a lot about using the synchrotron. Are you looking inside these poops? And if you are, what do you see?
I'll talk a little bit about taking the copper lights to the synchrotron scanner. So we went to ESRF in Grenoble, in France.
what accent was that?
Grenoble?
Is that how they say it?
I have quite a few French colleagues. I'd like to think some things.
Okay, Paleo Party would like to apologise at this point to any French colleagues that are listening.
So took, I think, 45 specimens to the scanner there. So we had 2 days of scanning session. And the thing about it there is that it's all the time. It goes 24 hours. So whenever a specimen stops, you have to be there, put it in, set it all up. But luckily with the copper lights, you can just stack them in a tube. So as long as you record which ones were, then you can just put it in there, let it go for 12 hours. So you can have your nice night's sleep and then come back.
It's literally a tube of crap.
Yeah.
Crap tube.
That is a completely different experience that I've heard of other people on the synchrotron, where they've been like bleary eyed, like staring at the screen, where this is like, just stuff it in a tube and send it off.
Exactly. Yeah. I had quite a few jealous colleagues over that. But
can imagine.
Yeah. And we use one of the longest beam lines there. So I think it's ID19, I think that's what it's called. And do you want the full name of the kind of what it's called?
Go for it. Yeah.
So in French accent, though.
Okay. No.
I'll go back to that. So it's synchrotron phase contrast microtomography.
Very fancy.
Nice.
That's not on OPCO or 5. just a wild guess, you know?
The cool things, that's what OPCO or 5
has. Oh, yeah, so
had to bring it down to. So essentially we get this fantastically high resolution, like really thin virtual, basically you get a stack of virtual thin sections. And so maybe for a copper light that is 5 centimeters in length, I might have 7,000 images. So 7,000 virtual thin sections. In fact, actually, to use it in the 3D imaging software, we have to bin it because it's so high resolution. Because it's in TIFF. Well, it depends. Okay, it depends on which 3D program you use. But the one that I use, we have to use TIFF. So you're talking like 300 gigabytes for one of those stacks of images.
So it's crazy to think 200 gigabytes of fossil crap.
Yeah.
Computationally
very expensive.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, who would have thought that poo would take so many gigabytes?
Yeah. So essentially then I use the 3D imaging software. So I use Mimix. Another couple of colleagues of mine use VG. You essentially just go through and try and threshold and work your way through. It's a bit like the Barney box, and essentially like you vaguely know what's going to be in there, but you're not 100% sure. So it's quite exciting. So you'd be like modeling out this little inclusion, and you kind of think, oh, what's this going to be? And then you you know, click the kind of render in 3D and you're like, oh.
So
make reaction gifs of Hannah's research. Yeah.
So like once you've got these virtual three-dimensional images, can you see things like bones and basically, I guess you see the last meals of these animals?
Yeah, so it's pretty incredible, the preservation of inclusions and coprolites, and that's why they're so valuable. I think particularly when you have such maybe poor or flattened preservation of body fossils in an assemblage. Because when the coprolite fossilizes, it does it rather quickly, so it keeps its 3D dimensionality, which means the contents inside are quite well preserved. And I've discovered a lot of what was producing the coprolites that I've been working on didn't chew a lot, because there's some big fragments in there.
I guess this is at the time in the fossil record where the like jaws are rather primitive. I hope I'm like categorizing that correctly, but everything is kind of like not chewing, but like hacking it down.
Yeah. Jaws haven't quite, they have jaws, but it's still in the evolutionary process of like power and that kind of.
But fish, like a lot of fish, the way their jaws work is that they sort of overextend the hinge and then suck in loads of water, and then whatever's there just happens to get sucked in too, right? And they swallow it whole. So, and sharks are quite, well, they don't have the same jaw, but they swallow a lot of stuff whole if they can.
Bit more munchy. Yeah.
A little bit more bitey. I guess.
So hacking it down and munchy and bitey are totally technical terms.
These are all paleontologically
you can cite us.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get to see their last meals. And I guess, so we've had one question, which is, do you find more poops belonging to predators or herbivores?
So that's a very good question. So the answer is more from predators, much more from predators, so carnivores. And that's because the carnivore or poo is more full of phosphate, and this helps in the fossilization process. Herbivores lack this, so you have to have much more special conditions for herbivore poo to be preserved. Mm. So yes, there is a bias for carnivore poops rather than herbivore poops.
So that's like, yeah.
With Thomas.
Well, I was just like my research is how things turn into fossils. That's what I'm interested in. I actually am working on a paper right now all about fossilization and that sort of stuff. And you do get herbivore poops, especially if they're eating very like phosphate rich, like algae and stuff like that. But yeah, like you said, carnivores are much more prevalent because their bones and things are full of phosphate. So they turn to rock or phosphate rock. A lot easier. Another question that has been asked is, does the proportion of food remains versus the byproducts tell you anything important? So when you're looking at these fossils, can you make ecological inferences?
That's an interesting question. So I think
it's a code word for I have a notion.
Yeah, exactly. That's the scientist way of saying
That's when you're at a conference and someone just asks you that really, and it just buys you maybe like a few seconds.
Brains
and then you're like,
turning around.
I'll talk to you after. So one thing about coprolites, so the hard inclusions are very readily preserved, and there is great potential for soft body preservation, but through the digestion process, most of that tends to be broken up versus the hard inclusions. So just because you have a lack of hard inclusions, it's maybe then hard to infer that, okay, maybe they're eating more soft body animals then versus those with harder elements in it. But a study actually won. So there was a PhD student who just defended Martin Kvarnström. He's the coprolite king. I'm just a mere mortal, really. I'm just hanging on the coattails to try and try and replicate the work he's done. So he's worked a lot on dinosaur coprolites. And he's worked on some coprolites that were pretty much like 90% like these huge bone fragments. So that indicated it's an osteophagy.
What, the eating of bones?
Yeah, they ate their bones.
Yeah. So that was quite insightful from, you know, that being so majoritive of the poop, then you could say, okay, that's probably then what it was doing. And also it had, so the teeth were really well preserved. So there was these big bone fragments and also these teeth preserved. And they were so well preserved that they can be compared to the body fossils from that site. I think it was from Poland. And it matched the producer that they predicted to come from. So it was probably through the osteophagy that it broke its own teeth and then swallowed it.
That's crazy.
That is cool. Well, there you go. Well, I'm going to change the tact just a little bit away from your research, just to let everyone know that in America, a pooseum exists. Which is a museum dedicated solely to fossil coprolites. And you can find information on the Pooseum at pooseum.com. But
do you work for them, or is this...
I'm just shouting them out. But
our sponsor today.
I wish. I should have approached them beforehand. But my question to you three is, can you tell me what the largest poop, fossil poop, in the Pooseum is? What animal made it? And how heavy do you think that poop is in kilos, because we don't work in pounds and ounces here?
Is this as a fossil, or
is it a fossil? It is a coprolite. I will give you a clue. It comes from the Miocene.
Actually think I know the answer to this, and I'm going to seem like an absolute idiot when I don't get it right, but is it a turtle?
It is not a turtle, I'm afraid.
Damn.
I'll give you another clue, is that it is named, this isn't a clue, it is named, it has a name, and its name is Precious.
Jeez.
So you could literally be like, you could hold it and be like, my precious.
Okay, can we have a clue? Is it terrestrial or non-terrestrial?
It's a little bit of A, little bit of B.
Oh, come on.
So, someone in the chat said 50 kilograms. You are going to be very disappointed when I tell you.
What? It's showing my ignorance of what was around during the Miocene.
hold on. Hannah's just, for those of you who are listening on the podcast, it's quite clear that Hannah has just turned on her laptop. Her screen just lit up. She is going to Google.
No. I'm just checking the age of the Miocene.
Well, I'm going to put you out of your misery. Precious is a 1.9 kilo fossil crocodile poop.
That
is massive.
Do I get like half a point for turtle because I was in the same ballpark?
I mean, no.
Oh, can we have a paleo party leaderboard?
Oh, a point system.
It's not going so well so far.
You should have like a quick round for like each of the guests.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that, but then I didn't want to, like, what happens if our guest scored 0 points in their own topic? That would be pretty sad.
Yeah, so. but that's like Mastermind, you know? Yeah. The subject you're an expert in. And...
Oh my God, there's nothing worse than watching Mastermind and watching them get zero in their own specialist subject. Ouch. No one wants that.
But I think the biggest coprolite is from big old T-Rex. And it's over 30 centimeters long, and it's 7 kilograms.
What? Whoa. Well, in that case, I may have been mistaken. This might have been the largest poop in the Pooseum.
Yeah.
I think you said that.
Oh, did I? Yeah. Well, I just wanted to confirm that. So,
questioner isn't very good.
I'm gonna hold on. Jim Jam. That's the name. They've just said in the chat, I have looked up a picture of this poop, and it is quite intimidating.
I want to know why they think it's intimidating.
Yeah, well...
Or do I? No, maybe I don't.
I mean, a 1.9 kilogram poop, if you think about how it was excreted, is quite intimidating. Just saying. Anyway,
going completely off topic, I saw a person comment a while ago as to why there's bunting in the background, and I'm going to answer on my background's behalf. I don't know if you can see, these are actually little dinosaurs on some of the little flags.
What?
And the only occasion that that signifies was lockdown. That was it.
Celebrating lockdown.
Nothing exciting.
Well, I just wrote that we're having a paleo party.
So. Oh, well, it works. Sorry. So, Chris, where's your bunting?
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got what Emma thought were brain scan diagrams in the background. Turns out it's actually a decorative rug.
Oh dear.
So swings and roundabouts.
So I'll work clearly on the brain, like.
We got a good question from Natalia. And which was that where was it? So she said she's working on a dinosaur game. And that she has been apparently the dinosaur game has dinosaur poop and weird shark poop. So, you know, take from that what you will. But the question was asked whether dinosaurs would have flat cowl-like poop. And I thought I'd put that to the group. What do you think? Do you think because they're quite tall that they would poop and it would...
There's got to be some splatter from a height, you know.
Way before that, like, you're assuming they have a herbivore digestive system, right?
Well, that's what I was going to ask next, because if you think about cows and you think about elephants, their poop is quite wet, right?
No, elephants is really dry, because some herbivores like suck all the moisture out.
Oh, okay, well, every day's a school day.
Have I just shown my hand as to how much I know about?
Yeah, why do you know so much about elephant poo?
I used to work in a zoo, and B, I'm a farmer, or I grew up a farmer.
What, an elephant farmer?
So, no, a cow farmer. So I have relative experience with cow pats and elephant poop. No elaborations, please, if you want to go into that.
So do elephants have flat poo or not?
No, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be wrong, but elephants, rhinos, and a few other in that kind of family or that group have really, really dry excrement.
Okay.
Because they absorb all the moisture from it because they have a predominantly like dry diet.
Mm. And that's one of the reasons why the wombat has the square poop, is because it retains a lot of the moisture, because obviously it lives in a very dry environment.
Mm.
And then it's somewhere in the guts process, then it gets packaged up in its little...
Mm. But Natalia's made a counterpoint, which is that mammalian herbivore poop is grass-dominated, but that would not be the case in dinosaurs. So do we think dinosaurs would have wet, juicy poops, is what I'm asking here. I need an answer. And as our resident dinosaur expert, Emma, I need an answer on whether they have juicy poops.
I love how, for any of these answers so far, I've been drawing on my experience from working in a zoo and my upbringing, not my actual expertise in dinosaurs. I have a notion. I actually don't know. I don't even know where to go to begin with.
Yeah.
But there is an extension of this, is that there is a lovely little correspondence style paper that came out maybe 10 years ago, 5 years ago now, that suggested that sauropod farts could have contributed to global warming given the amount of methane that they could have produced. So somebody has thought about this. We just need to contact them.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We're just going to go on a similar line, because there's that famous other, it's one of the best science diagrams ever, of the sauropods throwing up its vomit.
Onto a velociraptor, no less.
Yeah, no, it's supposed to have, like, this is one of the suggestions that it killed something, isn't it? Because it fell from such a height that this vomit has crushed something underneath. It's a genuine diagram from a paper, but it's absolutely amazing.
I mean, being sicked on from a brachiosaur would not be pleasant for anyone, I don't think. I actually have a really good paleo poo story, if you'd like to hear it.
Do we have a choice?
No, you don't have a choice. So about during my PhD a few years ago now, I was contacted by a member of the public who emailed our geology department and asked for some help. And this email was forwarded to me. And basically he said that he had a piece of fossilized poo, and he thought that it might be fossilized dinosaur poo. and would I be interested in having a look at it? So I said, of course, bring it in, and I will do my best to have a look at this dinosaur poo. And if it is, if it looks organic and we can work out what it is, then I can, you know, contact some colleagues and we can see if we can work out what it is. Anyway, so he turned up and he had this little package, and it was about the size of a large, like, sort of grapefruit. And it was wrapped in a blank, like in a piece of cloth. Anyway, he pulled it out and he took it out, and it was this perfectly smooth brown rock that had a completely flat bottom, and it looked just like a piece of poop. And so he proudly presented me with this rock and said, "Is this poo?" And as soon as I looked at it, I realized it wasn't poo because it had crystals in it. And because of those crystals, you could tell it was probably made by some sort of igneous, like volcanic activity. And because it was so flat and the area that the rock had come from, it's probably dragged there by a glacier in the last ice age and then dropped off when the glacier melted. So it wasn't poo, and I was very disappointed. But the best bit was afterwards when I was like, "I'm really sorry, I don't think it's poo." And he was like, "No matter, I'm going to take it home anyway." And I was like, "Okay." And he's like, "Yeah, I've been using it as a doorstop for the last 50 years. I was like, "Okay." So he just had it sitting around in his house for like 50 years. And then he was like, "Yeah, I'm just going to randomly take it to some geology department, see if it's poo."
What a build-up. To have it for 50 years.
I know.
Never asked the question.
I know.
Imagine waking up that morning and thinking, "Today's the day.
Today is the day." Anyway, that's that.
I wanted to move. Oh, sorry, Hannah, do you want to go first?
No,
I'm changing the topic.
No, I'm just going to end with that. That is quite an interesting one when you say, "Yes, I am a coprolite researcher," and then people just start bringing you stuff, and then they're just like,
"Oh God,
the coprolite, the coprolite," and it is quite a difficult thing unless you can see any internal stuff and say, "Okay, yeah, maybe there's an inclusion or something." Yeah, it's a bit. Or like the spiral structuring, yeah. So yeah, I did an outreach day at Stockholm Museum in February, and this lovely lady, she just started bringing me stuff that was labeled as coprolites there, and she's like, "What is it? Is it?" And I was staring at it like, "I don't know."
Oh dear. I actually went into a museum. I was working in a museum just before lockdown in America. And the first room that I entered, there was a big box. And on the box was a piece of paper. And it just said, "Do we need this box full of termite poo?" And I was like, I don't know. Do you? I hope they kept it. I really do.
But... I was going to change the topic to the Valencia trackways, just because I'm afraid we might run out of time and not get to mention it. Because... anybody who knows anything about Ireland's paleontology, it's utterly shocked. It's not great at all. So we really hang on to the Valencia trackways as like our major paleontological thing. You mentioned that you worked on them, though. What were you actually looking at? Or can you describe them, first of all, for anybody who's not in, like, gone to Ireland for these miraculous trackways?
Yeah. So a bit of history behind them. So they're discovered... I think back in 1993, I feel correct, by a Swiss paleontologist, actually, called Ivan Stussel. And I think he was there to look at the Variscan orogeny and saw these kind of, you know, very, yeah, trackway looking holes. Brain is dead today.
They are basically just like asymmetrical, if that's the right word, like something has gone along like very round little feet and just like plodded.
Yeah, essentially, like very, very classical looking, you know, what you would expect from kind of a four-legged trackway. And got in contact with some people and then produced a paper, I think, in 1996. And yeah, as you said, then kind of put Ireland on the map of like, whoa, we've got something great. So the original trackways are the Duhillit trackways. And I think in that specific site, there's kind of six separate trackways, with a couple of them being quite long. So yeah, quite quite neat little things. I mean, essentially the kind of size you're talking about is if you kind of curled your fingers up and then kind of start walking just on like this bit. So yeah, kind of like that. And then over the years, in collaboration with Ivan, some of my supervisors and other colleagues have discovered many more trackways. So I think we're up to maybe 26 or so trackways across the whole island. So a few more around the hill area, and then towards kind of northwest end of the island as well. So
I think we should clarify, we mean Valencia Island, not Ireland.
Yes,
the island of the islands.
Valencia Island is a tiny little island in the southwest, off the little bottom.
The Ring of Kerry.
Yeah. So not like 26 trackways in the whole of Ireland. We have more than that, generally.
Yeah,
speaking.
Yeah. Or it's near the Skelligs, which were used in the Star Wars movies. Yes. That was really funny because Port McGee, it's the village just off the island, on the island of Ireland, not an island. they push hard home on the whole Star Wars has been filmed around here. Like they have Mark Hamill pulling pints in one of the restaurants, and they have photos of this, and they have like jumpers with like Star Wars.
But didn't they introduce porgs, which are an invasive species, to the Skelligs? That's what I heard.
Yeah, terrible for the local ecology.
So you've got, lots of trackways, really lovely, especially when you get 3D scans of them. But we've got no body fossils.
None?
Nope. Well, okay, no tetrapod body fossils.
Yeah, no possible track maker fossilized in the surrounding rock.
Yes. I should clarify. So the trackways are in what's called Valencia slate. As soon as you hear the word slate, you think, it's been cooked a wee bit. Yes. Because it's part of the Vriscan orogeny, it's been metamorphosed, and different parts are metamorphosed to a different extent. So obviously that doesn't really help in your preservation of body fossils, but we do have lots of bits and bobs of what's called Bothriolepis, which is a placoderm, extinct fish that had a lot of armored plates and whatnot. Donkleosteus is probably the most famous, big lad.
I think
big fishy lad.
Also, for our listeners at home, there was a certain look of disdain on Hannah's face just then when she said that word. It was like, it's just a placoderm, isn't it?
Well, no. Bothriolepis. Any placoderm researcher, I think, will agree. I think also it doesn't do it justice because I think it's also one of these trash bin groups. Waste bin, yeah.
Because I think trash bin sounds
trash bin sounds like the American equivalent.
Because I think there's over like 50 or 60 species in it. And God bless, I have a colleague here trying to work through scans of this cooked placoderm material. So I've been there on two field trips, one September last year and then the year before. So the first year we went was basically kind of looking more on the island. So Ivan had found the trackways, but there was a student at Plymouth University back in the 50s who had found a couple of body fossil stuff on the mainland. So the slate formation extends onto the mainland to the south. So you'd find a couple of pieces there. So we went back to that site, found a couple of other pieces, and closer to the margin with the next formation, it's not as cooked, so it's not as deformed.
Cooked, and then, also another technical term.
Yeah. we have to leave it accessible to the people, you know.
Absolutely. We should adopt these more in our papers. Like, it would make so much more sense.
It would definitely. I
think
it's more fun.
Yeah, I think it's also my lack of trying to reach these terms.
It is late at night, and it's an hour later for you. Yeah. So.
Um, So yeah, and then last year then it was mainly getting a lot of 3D scans, and hopefully we'll be submitting a paper soon on our wondrous finds. Oh, we have quite an exciting one. I'm not sure. Yeah, no, I don't think I can talk about it. But it's a trackway from something else.
Oh, you're putting Ireland on the paleontological map. Oh, this is amazing. Yeah. Imagine an international team of researchers.
Oh. Also, like, do you not want to give a paleo party exclusive? Can you not like tell us what's going on?
That's kind of it, though.
Yeah, it's a trackway from something else.
It's a trackway from something else.
Yeah.
If someone in the chat guesses it, is that allowed?
No, I don't know. No. I can't see the chat.
So. Oh, okay, you're safe then. Well, I think someone's instantly replied, Porg.
ding, ding, ding.
Well, I think, you know, we're moving into the last 10 minutes of our stream this evening. So keep the questions coming in if you've got some. But it's that part of the show where I get to ask one of my famous, pointless paleontological questions to the group. And in honour of the fact that Hannah is at Uppsala University in Sweden, and Sweden has a heritage of Viking ancestry, my question for the group is, if you were a Viking raider / shield maiden, what paleo animal would you ride into battle? And I'm gonna send it to Emma first.
Without a doubt, a triceratops. Like, come on, you're sitting in behind its little frill, all cozy, you know, great.
What happens?
You're supposed to be vicious, not sat there like.
Yeah. What happens if it looks up and squashes you in its frill?
It'll have a harness so it like, only looks down, right?
Chris,
oh, it's in this plan, maybe.
Chris, what paleo animal would you ride into battle, Chris?
I think I'd have to go for the Viking kind of longboat approach and go for like a Shoneosaurus, one of the huge ichthyosaurs. Because they're pretty cool and they're massive. Be good for ramming other boats. Nice. And with a big old snout.
Absolutely useless if you have to fight a pitched battle on land or storm a castle, though.
I mean, this is true, but you know, it's everyone needs a specialty. Everyone needs some e-supports. I've played them in Age of Empires. I know how that could work.
Between the two of us, we have like on land, on the sea. We've got it covered.
You've got your army and your navy.
Oh my goodness, that's it. Hannah, Hannah, do you have an animal that you would ride into battle?
I mean, I have a soft spot for the marine side of things, so I think I'd go either Dunkleosteus or Titanichthys, which is the bigger Dunkleosteus. So yeah, that'd be terrifying.
So giant.
If I saw that coming towards me, yeah.
But the fact, well, how, okay, let's just talk for a second about the logistics of this. So are you underwater, Aquaman style? Or are you sat just with your head above the water, skimming along really quickly, and actually all the people can see is you just being dragged along by a giant armored fish?
No, I think I would do a bit of a submarine approach.
Cool.
you want to come in like, you know, stalking, you know, and you want to observe.
Yeah.
And you can kind of then launch it when you want to intimidate.
I think that's.
I feel everybody else's ideas have had less flaws than mine, and they're not even on land.
I like that someone in the chat has said that Chris riding a giant dolphin-looking thing dressed as a Viking is the manliest least camp thing ever suggested. Especially with your mustache. It depends whether the ichthyosaur is allowed to have a mustache as well.
Yes. The
answer is
always yes.
What would yours be?
I was thinking Arthropleura, which is this giant, like massive millipede that was alive like 400 odd million years ago. Just because I think a lot of people would just find it icky and would run away from it. But also like it's herbivorous, and I'd like to see people run away in fear of a herbivorous animal. I suppose you chose Triceratops, so you already get that.
Why is everybody hating on Triceratops?
I'm not. That was a good thing. I was saying it's herbivorous. Okay. And it strikes fear into people because of its horns, I guess.
True. Yeah.
It was just the way that you like portrayed it. You were like, oh, I'm just going to sit there really cozy. Or is
yeah.
it like, oh,
well, it's I don't need anything else. I have its horns because it can do, you know, the fancy stuff. And I'll just sit there and like steer it occasionally.
I've just got an image as well that, like, due to health and safety laws, you're going to have like a bleeper on it when it reverses. So it's like, it will just beep as you move backwards. Like, this vehicle is reversing.
I think all of our things are pretty, I think one thing we haven't accounted for as a, I mean, I'm assuming we're all on the same side in this imaginary battle.
I did not say that for the record. I didn't say that.
None of us have accounted for speed. We're all, as far as I'm aware, we're all fairly sluggish beasts. Which I, you know, hope maybe it's fine, but
slow and steady, right? Yeah. But I guess the millipede that would go at a fair whack if you wanted it to. How many legs?
Like? Well, I think the problem is though is that the Carboniferous when it was alive had significantly more oxygen in the environment than today. So my Arthropleura today would be wheezing, and I think it would just generally be asthmatic and struggling. But we have had a comment in the chat which said, how many Vikings can fit onto an Arthropleura? And I feel like that's a paleo joke that needs to be explored further. But they finished off their sentence with, is it the paleo equivalent of a tandem bike? And I suppose, yes, it is. That's what I was thinking, more of the mass transit of the Vikings than warrior steed. Anyway, on that bombshell, I think we'll leave it there for today. I think all good things need to come to an end, so we've run out of time. So I just want to say thank you very much for everyone who's tuned in today. We had way more viewers than I thought we were going to have. Thanks so much for all the comments and the questions. Paleo Party is going to be live streaming on Twitch every 2 weeks, and after each live stream we're going to record it as a podcast, which will be available at multiple podcast repositories. We haven't actually worked out how we're going to do that yet, but we'll come to it later. Information on our next stream, upcoming guests, and links to our website are on our Twitter page at Paleo Party. So don't forget to drop us a follow there and drop us a follow here. If you have any questions or any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. And I just want to say an extra special thank you to our guest Hannah for being our first ever Paleo Party guest and for having a lovely chat about poo. So a mini round of applause for Hannah. And thank you very much for tuning into Paleo Party, and we will see you all again in 2 weeks' time. So, bye, everyone.
Thanks for coming.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.